All right, the Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Cochran, Judge Selhas, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This case is the second today case on today's oral argument calendar for this panel. We are conducting, the case is number A19-2031, Rings Red and Others versus Duluth Economic Development Authority and Others. We are conducting the oral argument by WebEx video conferencing. It appears that we have both counsel on the line. Let me just, the judges previously heard another case for oral argument, and we did audio and video testing. Judge Selhas, by both video and audio, Judge Cochran is participating by audio only due to some technical glitches with her video, but she will be able to hear you. Let me just confirm that Judge Cochran is still on the line and is able to hear, and that we are able to hear her. Judge Cochran?
Good morning. Thank you. I'm on the line. On my end, it appears my camera's working now. Can you not see me though?
I cannot see you. So I wonder if there's a button you can press to activate your video. But if not, we can.
In any event, you can hear me.
Right. We can hear each other, so that's good. And I assume that Judge Selhas is still fully connected.
I am.
Very good. Let me first just check with counsel for respondent, who will argue second, but let me just do a sound check, video check. We can see you. Or is the audio working properly?
I believe it is. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Ringsred, if your setup is working properly, you may begin your argument on behalf of appellant. And could you clarify, please, I think in the briefs, I believe you're representing one appellant is there an agreement between the two appellants that you will present oral argument on behalf of both?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, you may begin.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Miles Ringsred, and I will be presenting the arguments on behalf of appellants today. And the key issues brought up on appeal boils down to DITA's and the district court's fundamental misunderstanding of the quote, potent, end quote, MIRA law, its precedents, its policies, and the standards that set, quote, an extremely high bar, end quote, for rejecting alternatives. The district court's opinion is littered with factual errors, abuses of discretion, and misapplication of the law. The district court gives every inference in favor of DITA's position, and in some instances goes far beyond and outside the record to reconcile and justify DITA's excuses for rejecting alternatives, and to the extent that DITA could very well have authored the opinion themselves.
Mr. Ringsred, let me stop you. I'd like to stop you there to ask you a question about standard of review. And it could be that there are multiple answers or ways of looking at this, but I'm wondering, are we primarily, chiefly, focusing on what you think are erroneous findings of fact, or should we focus primarily instead on an erroneous application of the law in light of certain facts? How would you characterize your appeal?
Yes, there are numerous. I think there are grounds for both erroneous facts, but I will be focusing primarily on the erroneous application of law in this case, reviewed de novo by this court.
Okay, you may proceed.
All right. Appellates recommend that this court have the following documents readily available when reviewing this case. There is an LHB report, which was commissioned by St. Louis County, which is marked as Trial Exhibit D7. There is the request for proposals from DITA, which is marked as Trial Exhibit D12. DITA Resolution 17D-07, which is DITA's resolution rejecting the proposals, which is marked Trial Exhibit D14, OCH/Heft proposal, which is marked as Exhibit D18, the Pastorette LLC proposal, marked as D19, and then the design plans by Bill Scalzo, which are attached to the Pastorette LLC and both proposals. And then also the landmark case state by Archibald v. Hennepin County. There are three points I would like to discuss and bring up as rather than waste time on very thorough briefing. One is an analysis of the Archibald case to the present case. Second is the shifting of the burden and the lack of evidence. And two, I'd like to focus on the OCH and Heft proposal. So perhaps the simplest way to illustrate the district court's fundamental misunderstanding of this potent mirror law, its precedents, its policies, and its standards, is to analyze a present case next to the strikingly similar landmark case, state by Archibald v. County of Hennepin. Appellates request the court put this case through the same scrutiny as the Minnesota Supreme Court did in Archibald, and in doing so, this court will easily identify grounds for reversal. In Archibald,
I have a question about that. It seems like in Archibald there were not questions about affordability. In other words, simply the ability of the owner to both to have the resources to do any of those projects and to have the liquidity to complete it. Seems like this case is different in both of those respects. Would you agree?
Not exactly. It's more of possibly more of a consideration in the present case. However, going through Archibald, the district court highlighted numerous areas that it found to be truly unusual factors, which the Minnesota Supreme Court rejected. And there are numerous factors in that case which the district court considered and the Minnesota Supreme Court held to be economic considerations and costs relating to the transportation of prisoners and costs relating to the expansions of these facilities. And so the cost analysis certainly does come in Archibald. And I will, I'll be coming back to that once I at a more prudent point in this analysis, if that's all right.
That's okay. You may proceed. May I suggest that you proceed to your third point by talking about the OCH Heft proposal.
All right. So when it comes to the OCH Heft proposal, this is where some of the clearly erroneous facts and really the shifting of a burden with lack of evidence. A big part of DITA's excuses for rejecting both proposals were the financial capabilities of these proposers. But there is nowhere on the record that actually establishes that they lacked this financial capability to pull this off. It wasn't exactly present in the proposals themselves, but there was zero follow-up or zero due diligence done by DITA to request this sort of information. And this was, and this in light of the paramount concern that DITA must be pursuing rehab of this property under, it really shifts the burden rather from the defendant, respondents in this case, establishing their burden of proof. It really shifted the burden back onto the appellates or to the plaintiffs in this case to establish that they did in fact have that financial backing and that capability. There's the proposals themselves show Mr. Rod Raymond, who was a very successful businessman in the area who has conducted multiple historic preservation projects, and Heft Builders, which is a multi-million dollar development company. And so just the facts themselves and these proposals and the shifting of burden that the district court allowed is not, well, warrants reversal in itself.
Mr. Ringsred, I'm looking at, I believe, part of that proposal, which I think is Exhibit 18. And with respect to financing, am I correct that there's only one line which says traditional local or regional bank financing? Am I correct that that's the only statement or the only information in the proposal about the plan for financing the project?
Yes. In that project specifically, yes. And there's multiple, we discussed this at length at the trial, in the trial court, where it just really the level of financial, needing to show the financial viability at that point in a process. Mike Conlin, who has very, very high credentials, used to work for the city of Duluth, was the boss of Mr. Hamry, who was a witness for DITA, and has many successful private and public endeavors in redevelopment. He testified that at this stage of the process, you're not opening up your bank accounts, and nor is it even possible to show the level of detail that DITA was rejected these proposals for. One, because if it was traditional bank financing, that only comes into the equation once they show site control, once they can approach a bank saying, here's our project, here we have something written from the people who own this property to actually be able to show that financial viability. And same with the Pastorette LLC proposal. To get a lot of the funding, they had to establish site control, and they could not do that until after the request for proposals were, until they were selected from one of those requests for proposals.
And there was also a concern about whether the proposals would meet HUD rules. Is that a valid consideration in terms of whether they're feasible and prudent alternatives?
So when it comes to feasible and prudent alternatives, Citizens to Preserve Overton Park, the U.S. Supreme Court case, really distinguishes feasible and prudent. Feasibility comes into this analysis in terms of is there enough scientific, is it actually possible, physically possible, like sound engineering, to be able to complete this? And when prudence comes in, prudence is where that you're not supposed to engage in a wide variety of economic or compensable and non-compensable factors. And when it comes specifically here, when it comes to HUD rules, sure, it could come into the equation. However, they did not come close to being able to establish that. That's not what we were there to establish. They showed that it isn't a concern of the HUD rules. But even in the same rule that DITA put forth, it talks about preserving historic resources. And Mr. Conlin discussed at length that the concentration of low-income housing was always a concern in the HUD rules. And so that real, and also he testified to the fact that this was really just an excuse, because in the surrounding area, not too far away from the Pastorette, the city allowed two low-income housing development projects to go in. And they never established that the Pastorette, if it did become a low-income housing proposal, that 3% of an increase in low-income housing in that area would cause costs of community disruption of an extraordinary magnitude, which is the standard that would be measured against. And when it comes to back to the low-income housing point, also that is not a concern in the OCH and HEFT proposal. They were going for workforce housing, whereas the Pastorette LLC proposal was going for low-income Minnesota housing finance credits for low-income housing.
Also, I have one more question for you. In paragraph 33 of the judge's order, the judge concludes there are truly unusual factors here. Simply put, there's no one who can credibly assert they will put this structure back together the way it was. No public or private developer or combination of the two has stepped forward in the last decade to show it can be done. So in your view, how did the district court err in concluding that there's truly unusual factors here because there's no proposal that would restore these properties?
So that's where the errors of law come in. If you would turn back from about number 29 of the opinion to 33 is where they really apply these standards to the facts. You can see in 29, it says with enough towards the second to last line, with enough money, anything is feasible. That's an error of law. Feasibility isn't about money or the costs of stuff. And then he goes on and says prudence and goes on to define prudence as an extremely narrow standard, but this is not what is reflected in the case law. It's not about a wide-ranging balance of compensable and non-compensable factors. That is exactly what was rejected in Overton. And so if you go on to number 31, he credibly believes that the reasons for rejecting the proposals for a housing mix, both proposals was not sought in the RFP, low job creation, did not appear any commercial developments, an inadequate increase in tax base. The Archibald case specifically addresses many of these factors and finds them to be this wide-ranging balance of compensable and non-compensable factors that is found to be inappropriate in this analysis. That is why, and when it comes to economic considerations, like many, actually almost every single consideration in this, you measure that in Archibald, it's clear that you measure that against to show that the cost does come into the equation, but it's the burden of the defendants to show that that costs would somehow cause costs of community disruption of an extraordinary magnitude that was never done in the district court and that is not reflected a single time in the court's opinion.
Time is expiring, but I have one or two more questions I would like to ask. And if other judges have questions, I think it would be appropriate to hear them as well. My question is, Mr. Ringsred, you, the plaintiffs, appellants in this case are an individual who has an interest in preservation and an organization. Neither of the entities submitting the two proposals are parties to the case. But are you suggesting, from your client's point of view, that the OCH Heft proposal is perhaps the one that's more feasible and more worthy than the other?
Perhaps. I think there are less concerns in that, simply just because the HUD rules further complicates things. Getting the Minnesota housing finance credits for low-income housing is a competitive process. It really would require a fine look at those rules and the testimony behind that and the reasons that those in Pastorat LLC, the reasons they never acquired those. Not once was the application for those tax credits rejected on the merits. It just was not put into the running for a couple of simple procedural reasons and mistakes on MHFA's part. But I think for simplicity's sake, the OCH Heft proposal is a much more straightforward analysis for us.
Does the OCH proposal depend at all on public benefits or tax credits or the like?
Both projects were dependent on, and in many cases in historic preservation, in historic preservation tax credits. It's not a competitive process. It's a process that a very lengthy process you go through with the Federal Department of Interior and the Minnesota Historical Society. And Pastorat LLC, who was associated with Dr. Ringsred, and until the project was taken away in 2015, had spent substantial sums of money and obtained these tax credits. Those were in the pockets. So, and those cover 40% of any development cost. So no matter how much that was, 40% of the cost would be shouldered by those tax credits.
And who provides the tax credits? Which governmental entity?
Half of it comes from the state and half of it comes from the federal government. It's a bit of a complicated syndication of credits. It allows usually banks and people with large capital with a lot of income tax can offset that by purchasing these tax credits, in a nutshell. And these were already secured.
Do either of the other judges have any further questions for Mr. Ringsred at this point? It appears not. Thank you, Mr. Ringsred. You will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Ms. Sellers, on behalf of the respondents, City of Duluth and Duluth Economic Development Authority, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The standard of review that this court should apply is a clearly erroneous standard as to the findings of fact. The issue of whether the appellate court should primarily be applying that clearly erroneous standard or a less deferential standard is an issue that the Minnesota Supreme Court addressed head-on in Archibald, looking at the difference between a MIRA appeal and an appeal under a different statutory scheme, such as the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act, MAPA, or the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, MEPA. Neither one of those applies here. And so the review of the court's findings is a clearly erroneous standard. Central to the trial here and also to the appeal is whether the defendants and the respondents met their burden of proof to establish no feasible and prudent alternative. That's a question of fact. This court should apply the deferential, clearly erroneous standard to the trial court's findings there.
Counsel, I have a question for you. MIRA provides that economic considerations alone shall not constitute a defense under MIRA. Your clients had the duty to establish an affirmative defense. What in the district court's order regarding whether or not your client met its burden of proof pertains to anything other than economic considerations?
The district court addressed a number of other considerations, including the type of housing incorporated in the two formal proposals for historic rehabilitation. In the one case, the low-income housing, which would require the tax credits, and as the court has already noted, presented certain problems for HUD regulations purposes. In the HEFT, the other proposal, there were also problems with the type of housing being entirely untested in the Duluth market and being a risky proposition that would effectively eliminate white.
But counsel, the district court noted in paragraph 29 that a number of witnesses testified that with enough money, anything is feasible. And so didn't the witnesses themselves acknowledge that with respect to the issues raised and the criticisms of the proposals, that with enough money, any issue that was a problematic could have been gotten around by money?
With all respect to the district court here, I believe that that statement in paragraph 29 is a bit of an overstatement of the trial evidence.
Are you challenging the findings on appeal?
No, Your Honor. Because perhaps any amount of money could physically restore the property, could physically accomplish the historic renovation. Neither of the proposals, though, even if money were no object, neither one met the standard, which is both feasible and prudent.
Yes, but when we can see that the Supreme Court points out to us the statutory language in Archibald, that economic considerations alone shall not constitute a defense here under, what can you tell us about the district court's order here that constitutes truly unusual factors that are not economically related?
Yes, and to be clear that economic considerations are not a defense to that feasible and prudent taken together.
Well, I'm talking about truly unusual factors, which is set forth in Powderly. It says, resources should not be polluted or destroyed unless there are truly unusual factors present in the case or the cost of community disruption from the alternatives reaches an extraordinary magnitude. I don't think we're talking about the latter in terms of disruption, but what are the truly unusual factors in this case?
This building has been condemned for habitation for nearly a decade. In the first part of that decade, it was controlled by one of the appellants here, who is an avowed historic preservationist, clearly takes the MIRA directives to heart, and sees the seriousness and the value in historic preservation.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm just because of time constraints, I'm going to interrupt you. Your client took ownership of the property in October 2016. Was there some law that required your client to take ownership of the property after the tax forfeiture?
No.
Okay, so your client took ownership of the property knowing that the property was on the historic registry, just like Hennepin County did in Archibald. What did your client do to restore and protect this historical asset during from 2016 until 2018?
For immediate protection, my client boarded up the windows, put up fencing, and protected it from the elements and the intruders. That's an ongoing process and the work continues today. Looking to the longer term, my client reached out to the State Historic Preservation Office, to the Duluth Heritage Preservation Commission, to developers with known track records for historic preservation, seeking a development partner, seeking input on who could help to fix this up. DETA is not in the business of that itself. It lacks the capacity to do that. So reaching out through numerous veins, it also put out this request for proposals. And we walked through it in our briefing, we walked through that trial, the emphasis that DETA put on historic preservation in that process.
That's you know, I have some concerns about that request for proposal. Why would DETA, in its initial request for proposals, include one of the three proposals as a request for demolition of the property? That seems very odd to me before it determines whether there are truly unusual factors.
That's not an issue that was directly addressed at trial, I don't believe. My understanding in the request for proposals process, and this I believe was touched on at trial, is that it's intended to be a broad, casting as wide a net as possible, seeing what just soliciting as many bids as possible to see what might make sense for the site. The emphasis in the request for proposals, nonetheless, was on preferring historic preservation. This is where the trial court noted that the trial court found that DETA acted in good faith through this process, The trial court found it credible that Dita believed it had reached the end of the line, that it had done everything it could to identify a story preservation option, but was unable to do so.
Go ahead, Judge Shellhouse.
In paragraph 31 of the court's order, the court notes that both of the proposals that dealt with a housing mix, that Dita received, did not address the low job creation. They didn't appear to be any commercial development in the mix, and there was inadequate increase to the tax base. All three of those are entirely economic considerations. How can we not view this order as an order that determines that truly unusual factors are economic considerations?
Those factors also go to the blighted condition of the property, and that goes to the public health, safety, and welfare issues that are also part of the MIRA statutory affirmative defense, and also part of the reason that Dita must be allowed to go ahead and do something productive with this property. It spent years looking for an option to preserve, historically preserve property. There was no alternative that was both feasible and prudent. And at some point—
Council, let's go back to whether there really was no alternative that's feasible and prudent. Other than the financial capability of the proposers for the two proposals that were considered, for each proposal, what made the proposal not feasible and prudent?
There are a number of factors, and they're addressed in Dita's resolution and in the trial transcript, but they include the type of housing.
Is there a legal requirement that there be a certain type of housing? Or was that just a preference of Dita?
Well, there's the issue of the HUD regulations as to the low-income housing on the one, and then there is the untested nature of the micro units as to the other proposal. In addition—
So, but the HUD regulations, let's go back to that for a minute and drill down on that. Is there any legal requirement that the redevelopment be consistent with HUD regulations, or was that just the type of development that the proposer was putting forward?
Mr. Hamry testified to this at trial, but it was Dita and the city's concern that running afoul of the HUD regulation would put other city financing, that is other federal financing to the city and to Dita, at risk if the city and Dita moved forward with a project that would result in concentrations of low-income housing in violation of the HUD regulation.
Okay, thank you.
In addition, there were problems with the developers' historic projects of this magnitude as to that Heft proposal.
Ms. Sellers.
One signal to Ms. Dita Sellers. As to both proposals. Yeah.
I'm sorry, could you please repeat those last two sentences? I missed what you said, I think, because the screen froze briefly, but if you could go back about two sentences. And I think you were turning to the OCH Heft proposal. Could you please repeat that part of your argument?
Yes, and the concern there for Dita, among other things, was the lack of the developer's experience in historic preservation projects. Dita was not satisfied from the materials in the proposal that the proposers had the wherewithal to see a historic rehabilitation project of this magnitude through. In addition, neither of these proposers nor anybody else has come forward who is willing to put their own skin in the game, which in Dita's experience shows that the developers themselves, the proposers themselves, have limited, if any, confidence in the proposals that they're putting forward.
On that point, I mean, isn't it true that the OCHF proposal, well, it relies entirely on private financing, it seems, but okay, how do you know that the OCHF proposal does not involve any skin in the game? And also, if I'm incorrect in understanding that the OCHF proposal relies on, depend upon historic tax credits, I think.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, but maybe my question is, how do you know that the proponents of the OCHF proposal do not have any skin in the game?
The financial part of the proposal is in a very short portion, which the court has already cited earlier in oral argument, but that lists that the financing would be from historic tax credits, which they had not yet obtained, traditional financing, but then it also references additional public funds. Mr. Hamry testified to this at trial. There is no greater specificity from Heft as to what those other city or county or other public funds would be, nor had anyone from Heft communicated with DETA or the city about the potential for additional funds from the city or otherwise.
But where would I find that reference to additional public funds? I don't see it on the same page as the one I mentioned about traditional local or regional bank financing.
Let's see.
Somewhere else in the record, and perhaps.
It's in that same exhibit. And it's on the very first page of the substance of that proposal.
Don't want to take too much of your time, but I think I will review exhibit 28 then after the argument. You may proceed with your argument. Looks like your time has expired. And again, if other judges have questions, I have one more question, and I guess it's a very basic question, which is, maybe it's not so much a legal question, but I guess in a very general sense, I mean, why would the city not at least give one of these a try? I mean, what's to lose? I mean, there was skepticism, perhaps, and there were unanswered questions, perhaps, and there's the argument by appellants, I think, that respondents should have done some more made some more inquiries or done some due diligence. But let's just say, even if they know what they know, given what they knew, why not just give one of them a try, especially the one that is less dependent on public financing and apparently not reliant at all on local, would not put any burden on the local taxing entities. I mean, what's the worst thing that could happen, and why would that be worse than demolishing a historic resource?
The worst that would happen is a project that starts and does not get completed. Given the lack of experience by the developer and the significant funding shortfalls.
And why is that? Why is that worse for the city as an entity, the economic authority as an entity, and the residents of Duluth?
Because the property has an ongoing blighting influence on the neighborhood. Either of these two proposals that we've been talking about this morning would take a matter of years to get off the ground, to have them get off the ground and get no further, not to be completed, sets the city and DETA back another matter of years. Meanwhile, the building continues to attract crime, continues to be a magnet for solid waste. It's an attractive nuisance, and it has a negative effect on the community health, welfare, and safety. It's an ongoing problem for the community.
Judge Johnson, can I follow up on that?
Yes, you may. Go ahead.
Ms. Sellers, if the city had decided to move forward with one of the proposals, what would have been the next steps? What would have been the timeline?
I don't know. I don't believe that we addressed that at trial.
Thank you.
It appears that there are no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Sellers, for your argument. Mr. Ringsred, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. You may proceed.
All right, I'd like to just quickly hit on a few points in terms of the standard of review. Yes, there are clearly erroneous standards that we need to measure some things by. However, even in Archbold conclusions of law, which the misapplication of the standards of this court into the facts here and such, there are plenty of conclusions of law that were that this court should review de novo. And then whether something is feasible is not exactly a find of just a finding of fact. The evidence going into it would be findings of facts, but the standard by which the court measured that is a conclusion of law, which it erroneously made in this case. Then we, Ms. Sellers spoke about economic considerations, and you asked a question about those, and she talked about the types of housing. This is a compensable factor that is not supposed to be balanced, this wide-ranging balance of compensable and non-compensable factors that is not supposed to be taking place. Indeed, the paramount concern is supposed to be protection of the resource. Then someone spoke to, with enough money, anything is feasible. And that is, and that's correct. But nowhere in this this consideration did DITA ever show that it could not itself do this project. It bases a lot of on a lot of hypotheticals, and it is had currently DITA had went through a $30 million restoration of the historic North Shore Theater, which it's worth noting that appellate Dr. Ringsred is the only reason that property is also still standing. Then we went on to talk about truly unusual.
I have a question. So am I correct that the district court did not give, in the order, did not give a lot of attention to the possibility or the prospect of the city or the economic authority doing its own redevelopment? That didn't seem to be something that was on the table. Am I correct about that? And if so, why was that the case?
That was on the table. That was something we brought up in the district court as possibilities and other alternatives. I think it's worth noting that DITA took this property from the developer, Pastoret LLC, that has Mike Conlon at the helm, who I have mentioned has credentials. As he testified that he is one of 10 people with a level of credentials for economic development that he has. He has extensive experience in both private and public development processes. He's the one who secured these historic preservation tax credits. And DITA went out of its way to take this property, and this is on the record, so that the property does not go back into the hands of Dr. Ringsred.
So is there extensive evidence in the record about how DITA did that North Shore Theater project, and you know, in other words, did it act as the general contractor, general developer throughout that, or did it request RFPs and let the project out for other people to invest their time and resources and risk? Or I'm just wondering. I don't know much about that, and I'm wondering if that was fully included in the record. And I guess, am I correct in? I'm asking a compound question here, but am I also correct in the way I'm reading the district court order it was not a focal point of the order?
It was not a focal point of the order. It was brought up, and we asked the district court to consider that because there was no evidence to show that they even considered this or that this was not a feasible or prudent alternative. DITA purchased the property, the North Shore Theater themselves, and did the work and are still the owners of it. There was also some considerations in terms of the condition of the property. They make a big deal about the dilapidated and the condition of it, but this was the same condition of the armory in the Archibald case. They go at length talking about the condition of the property. And then there was some reference to that resolution D17D-07, which is where DITA rejected these proposals. And every single reason and excuse given by DITA is a compensable factor. Once again, the entire process is littered with this wide-ranging balancing of compensable and non-compensable factors, which has been roundly said to be inappropriate in these contexts. And further, if you go to the end of that that resolution, it specifically says that goes on to talk about new jobs and these new tax bases as being this as being these considerations, and the how the property would enhance the Hartz District, which is the new district that the city designated downtown, the historic arts district. And then it went on to say that restoration of the structure would be a desirable factor, but the benefits to the Hartz District and the economic viability were the paramount goals of the RFP. And another error of law by the judge is, despite all of these, despite all of the city's animosity towards this property, which is very well documented on the record, and despite these admissions, the district court found that protection of this resource was DITA's paramount concern, simply because it issued this RFP.
Thank you, Mr. Ringsred. If there are no further questions,
Judge Johnson, can I ask a quick question?
Yes, you may. Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Mr. Ringsred, can you briefly respond to Ms. Sellers' point about the HUD regulations, and that if the development was not consistent with HUD regulations, that there was testimony that it would put other financing at risk, other city financing at risk?
Yes, I sort of touched on this before. Mr. Hamry is one who testified to that, but I think it's worth noting that these are all purely hypothetical. They pointed out that it was a concern, but there was nowhere near the level of evidence to show that this would actually have any kind of influence on the funding they received under HUD. There's plenty of evidence to show that consideration of a deconcentration has always been a consideration in these HUD regulations. And I might add that in the same HUD regulation they cited, historic preservation is another factor to take in consideration when you're considering these HUD funding and low-income housing financing. And also, it really is telling that this is a concern of theirs when they allow two other development projects, where Mr. Conlin discusses on the record, the city allowed two other low-income housing projects just right down the street and in the very near vicinity of the Pastorette. So either they're misstating how serious of a detriment this would be to any kind of HUD funding, or maybe they lost their HUD funding because of these projects, but this is exactly what the Pastorette was proposing. And further, there's nothing on the record that shows if the Pastorette was to turn into low-income housing, it would only increase low-income housing in the area by 3%. There's nothing on the record that shows that this small percentage would cause them to lose any HUD financing, and there's nothing on the record to show that they could disperse low-income housing by removing low-income housing in other places. Low-income housing, when you work with, typically when you're going for the Minnesota tax, low-income housing tax credits, it's a staggered 15-year and then a 30-year mark. After 15 years, your proposal to them to get this kind of housing requires them to, whatever's in the proposal, this is how many low-income housing units you're going to have. After 15 years, that's relaxed a little bit. And then after 30 years, you could turn that property into anything that you wanted. You could turn it back into the six townhomes that Oliver Traphagen originally designed that property for. You could do whatever you want with it. And so that would be my response to their, and is backed up by testimony when it came to the their HUD regulation concern.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days as required by statute.